You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
St. Patrick's Day seems like the perfect time to take a look at the events that brought the ancestors of 44 million Irish immigrants to America. Mary Pat Kelly's novel Galway Bay follows one family's journey from a small fishing village to this country. It's just out from Grand Central Publishing, and I'm pleased that it brings Mary Pat Kelly to the show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
You begin your book with a quote from your great-great-grandmother, Honora Keeley Kelly. "We wouldn't die," and that annoyed them. Why were they annoyed?
Well, over the centuries, the English, the occupiers of Ireland, had really tried to decimate the population. It was down to 300,000 when Cromwell slaughtered. And then they came back. And, of course, the secret weapon was the potato. By the time my story starts in 1839, there was a population of 10 million. So there was always the feeling that no matter what they did, the Irish kept coming back. And the potato, because it was nourishing, had much more vitamins than anyone knew at the time, was the weapon that allowed them to come back.
Ironically, the potato comes from the Andes.
Right, exactly.
And it went from being non-existent in the New World to being the basic crop of Ireland.
Yes. It was the crop that the people lived on. They raised other crops, but they were like sharecroppers in our – and those all went to the landlord. So the potato was their subsistence.
The equivalent of rice in Asia.
Exactly.
But when the potatoes started going bad, couldn't they have just switched to something else?
Well, they didn't – they would have to buy the food. The crops were still taken to England. Ireland was the breadbasket of England. The landlords owned the crops. I mean, the people had to watch tens of thousands of tons of wheat and cattle and butter and just being exported. And any attempt to stop it. In the early days when the Great Starvation first began, there were demonstrations and they tried to shut the ports, but they brought in 30,000 soldiers. Now, other countries that had the blight did close their ports and kept the food within. But the food was exported all through the 5 years of the Great Starvation.
Now, this book is a novel,
right.
And yet I suspect a lot of it is history and a lot of it is your family history. You've even retained real names.
Yes, I did. I kept the real names of the people. I had spent a long time studying Irish history and reading about it, but I never felt this kind of visceral connection until I stood on the little piece of earth. As you said, the fishing village where Honora Keeley was born, and then went to the farm where she and Michael Kelly raised their children. Then it all became personal. So when I wanted to tell the story, though it is fiction, it was really based on their lives.
And you could find the place? Because Kelly is a kind of common name in Ireland. There could have been any number of Kelly families.
Huge. I mean, it took years. In fact, there was a funny moment when my father was traveling with me in 1979, and we went to Galway City. My father had a vague notion that they came from Galway. But I grew up in Chicago, and being Irish was really about John Kennedy and turning the river green on St. Patrick's Day. Ireland was almost an impossible place to get to in our minds. But he was traveling with me. We went to the town clerk, and my father said, "Hello, I'm Michael J. Kelly." And the town clerk said, "So am I." Mm. And, you know, so are most of the men within the area. But this great-great-grandmother had a granddaughter who was still alive. Her name was Agnella. She was a nun who lived to 107. And she remembered enough to give me a maiden name. And then I just kept looking and looking, first through microfilm, and finally the breakthrough was when Ireland computerized the records.
And your story ends with Honora telling her story to her great-granddaughter, Agnella. We meet Honora Keeley in 1839 on the morning of her sister Marie's wedding. Marie spelt like mare.
Right.
And she meets her future husband, Michael Kelly. Now, we have Keeleys and Kellys here.
I know. It would have been easier if there was a different name, but those
but
are the real names.
Are they variants on the same name?
Actually, Keeley comes from an Irish word, and it means, thank goodness, comely. And the Keeleys were the lords of Connemara in early days, before the O'Flahertys came in, and then the Normans came in, and then the English came in. And it's funny, it's two different words, but two different names, but they do sound a lot alike.
So you get a Keeley Kelly here. The Keeleys were fishermen living on the shores of Galway Bay. Was there good living to be had from fishing in those days?
Their fish was sold, and again to pay the rent, because they had to pay for fishing rights and they had to pay the rent on their cottages. The Irish couldn't own anything. At the beginning of the 17th century, the Irish owned 95% of the land. By the end, the English owned 95%. So even the fishermen had to live on potatoes. But there was a great wealth of spiritual culture, of song, of stories, so that I would say that there was a happiness there in spite of the material poverty.
Although it was also dangerous. Husband Johnny is lost shortly after they get married. What would happen to a young widow like her? She's 18 years old.
Yes, it was very difficult. I mean, there was a sense that your life then, until you married again, there was not a position necessarily for a widow except an elderly kind of a widow. But Mari has her own ways of surviving. In many ways, it's a story of two sisters and their different ways of surviving.
In case listeners haven't figured it out by now, the villains of this story are the landlords, the Brits, especially the scoundrel Pikes.
Yes, exactly.
Were there any good British landlords?
Yes. Well, there were landlords that had kind of a more benign attitude toward their kind of a feudal, but it never reached the level of policy. I mean, when we talk about the British, we're talking about an imperial government that saw Ireland as a colony and the people as kind of annoyances.
Well, there were two groups that seemed to be controlling things, the British and the clergy. When Mary wants to remarry, the priest stops her.
Right. There's this strange thing that
she's very beautiful. I think a lot of people would want to
marry.
Right.
Even though Johnny was lost at sea, there's a question that if he isn't really dead, could she marry again? And it was interesting. In earlier times, the religion was much more of a folk religion, and there really was little control by the clergy in that kind of. In fact, the priests were very heroic. They would come in to say Mass and risk their lives. But just about the time when this story is starting, there began to be a more bureaucratic attitude, more law-based, and that's what Mari runs up against.
Although the law sometimes seems to be a little difficult when Honora and Michael marry, the scoundrel Pikes demand a droit de seigneur.
Yes.
Now, I can't believe, first of all, you probably should explain what that is, but I can't believe that existed in 1840 or so.
It existed well into the 20th century. I was amazed, too. I first found references to it in this particular area in a local history, and then I spoke to the priest. And the droit de seigneur was that the landlord had the right to the first night of the bride. It's a medieval kind of attitude, but it went all the way down.
And what would happen if the bride refused?
Well, the family would be evicted. I mean, it was really the hand of the landlords on the people. It can't be exaggerated how controlling it was. Because if you were evicted, that was it. I mean, there was no other place. You couldn't go get a job somewhere. That land was what you needed to live.
And the priest, Father Gilly, supports the British claim.
Well, the idea with the priest is that they won't stand up. They won't jeopardize the rest of the people about this one situation. In Ireland, they have a thing, turned a blind eye. There was a lot of turning a blind eye to situations during this time.
Well, but she'd be losing her virginity to a man who she wasn't married to.
Right, exactly. But they pretended it didn't happen. When I was there, I watched there was an interview on the television, the local television, and a woman was reminiscing about that even in her day there was something of that. And the maids in the big house, I mean, It was in a different form, but it was the same idea.
My guest is Mary Pat Kelly, who has published a novel, 5 nonfiction books, also written and directed documentaries, as well as the feature film Proud, a film that starred Ossie Davis and also Stephen Ray.
Yes, Stephen Ray was in it.
And now her book, Galway Bay, is published by Grand Central Publishing. The potato famine seems to hit all at once. Did it come that quickly?
It did. It came in one night in 1845. In one night, half the potato plants just died.
They turned to black slime?
Black slime. Now, the first time it was kind of checkerboarded. Some fields survived, which even made it more confusing. But the second time in the autumn of 1846, they were all devastated, gone.
Anybody know why?
There was a lot of theories, crazy things like, you know, electricity in the air. It was connected to the weather. I mean, still to this day, in big potato growing places, like we spend our summers in northern Wisconsin, when it's very humid, people are afraid because it's a fungus. That's what was discovered. But that wasn't discovered for another 30 years.
Didn't even know there was such a thing as a fungus.
They didn't know. And in fact, there was a kind of a thing where they was almost blaming the farmers, like, what did they do? But it was this fungus that just would penetrate the plant and kill all the potatoes.
So Honora and her family eventually decide to go to America, to Chicago, where Michael's brother Patrick has settled. I would have thought Boston or New York, where there were such large Irish populations.
Well, there was work in Chicago.
And the O'Learys, we know about the Chicago fire in 1871. At least one other Irish family there.
Right, exactly. There were quite a few Irish there because they were building the Illinois and Michigan Canal, the canal that really made Chicago the focal point, the transportation center of the country. And so there was work. Agnella told me that she remembered the old women sitting around, and if you'd ask someone, how's your husband? And she'd just say, working, thank God. I mean, when there was work, that's where you went.
They say that now in Detroit. The children are put to work in slaughterhouses. They work in quarries and other businesses. I guess there were no child labor laws in those days.
No. In fact, then it was later on when those kinds of situations brought the Irish into the union movement and protesting things like child labor. I mean, it came from their own experience.
And Patrick Kelly, who they have come to see, has become something of a mythical figure in Chicago. He lives with the Indians and organizes workers as well as agitating for a free Ireland. Wants
right.
to create an Irish free state in Canada.
Exactly.
Is this a real person?
Well, yes. I mean, I put a couple of people together. But as I say, we spend our summers in northern Wisconsin. And the Ojibwa tribe had a Martin Lynch that lived with them. And it was pretty common for Irishmen to maybe marry an Indian woman and become attached to a Native American tribe. And that was the source of some of that. And also, the whole Fenian thing has been misunderstood. During the Civil War, there were 50,000 members of the Fenian Brotherhood in both armies of the North and the South. And the idea was, after this problem was settled, and then they would go and liberate Ireland. But kind of an interim step would be to establish a government in exile in Canada. And they had the support, I mean, the American government, in the sense, if you do it, we'll recognize you.
Well, we weren't as friendly with Canada in those days, and it was a British outpost.
It was a British outpost, and it was a collection of just provinces. And the government was angry with the British because they had supported the South during the Civil War and built ships. So there was even a sense of taking it over as a reparation.
And during the Civil War, an Irish brigade is formed to fight for the Union. I'm assuming there were also Irish units fighting for the South.
Yes. There
was a possibility that you could be fighting your own cousin?
Exactly. In fact, I met a man when I was doing my research in Galway named Eugene Malloy, who was from Nashville. And we discovered that our great-great-grandfathers had shared the same piece of land. And, of course, when I heard his accent and thought Nashville, I thought, well, wait a minute, here is the real thing. And it turned out, I made it up, but it turned out to be true that his great-uncle fought with the Rebel Sons of Erin in Tennessee against and was taken to Camp Douglas, the prison camp in Chicago, and yet was released under mysterious circumstances because the Irish did find a way to help each other.
Now, what happened to the Canadian Rebellion?
They reached Canada. They were, for about 5 days, there was a place where they raised the flag, but then it was the American army that stopped further reinforcements from crossing over.
You include a glossary of Gaelic words.
Yes.
Do you speak Gaelic?
No, unfortunately. In fact, as I was doing the book, one of the biggest senses of loss I had was the language, that here they had come speaking this language that is so evocative and has so many levels of meaning, and it was completely lost to me and to the generations that came from them. So I wanted to just sprinkle a few words in that will give a sense of the speech.
You have blurbs from some of my favorite writers, Frank McCourt, Mary Gordon, Eric Foner, the wonderful historian, Peter Quinn. Are these all friends of yours? Or
friends, but friends that I knew would only give me the blurb if they really liked the book. And Eric, I just wanted to make sure I got the Civil War as right as possible. But Frank's was amazing when he said, "What laughter, tears, and pure magic." So I was extremely grateful.
Mary Pat Kelly's Galway Bay is published by Grand Central Publishing. Thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thank you. And I was supposed to mention my website, marypatkelly.com.